Well, hey, as Steve mentioned, we like to, a couple times during the year, find a book just to work our way through and just see what God wants to speak to us through it. And for this summer, we're going to do that by walking through the book of Esther. And so if you have a Bible with you, I'd encourage you to turn to the book of Esther. I thought of sort of trying to do it in a creative way and starting from the end of the book and working to the beginning, but it just was too confusing. So we're going to start at chapter 1 today and move our way through the end. And right off the top, if I can just sort of leave you with a little bit of a challenge, would you consider taking time this week to read through the whole book of Esther from start to finish, and if possible, in one sitting? It's only 10 chapters long, and chapter 10 is 3 verses. So I think you can pull this off. But it's always best for us to look at smaller chunks of books, whether they're verses or even chapters, within the context of the whole arc of a book, what the writer's trying to say. And so if you can manage that this week, to read Esther start to finish, I think it'll be helpful in creating an even deeper and more rich experience as you come Sunday mornings during the summer. Well, what is the book of Esther really all about? Well, the book of Esther is ostensibly a narrative which, in Jewish life, plays a central role in providing the background and purpose associated with the holiday of Purim, which is unique in that it's the only biblical festival that's not spoken about in the Torah. The Torah never makes reference to Purim. Only the book of Esther sets the stage for it. And so to give you a little bit of a flavor of what this holiday, this Jewish festival is like, I have a little news clip that I'd like you to just quickly have a look at.
Well, Jews around the world are celebrating Purim tonight, a joyous holiday that teaches lessons about strength and pride in identity.
So don't be surprised if you see lots of kids in colorful costumes. CBS 2's Cindy Hsu explains.
Hello.
In the Rappaport home in Borough Park, children are wearing costumes because Queen Esther, the heroine of the Purim story, had to disguise her Jewish identity to survive, but then revealed herself to save the Jewish people. Children go house to house collecting donations for charity.
We collect a lot of money for the schools because it's one of the 4 commandments of the day.
Another commandment is listening to the Book of Esther, which tells the story of Purim, and many families are bringing gifts of food to friends. When it comes to traditional dishes eaten on Purim, such as stuffed cabbage or kreplach, which are dumplings filled with meat or potatoes, the hidden part of the food has special significance.
The good part is hidden and wrapped up. So we have to know that in all of nature, we don't see God, but he's hidden somewhere.
Many are heading to local bakeries for special treats, like this huge Purim challah.
Beautiful, colorful Purim.
This is going to feed a lot of people.
It is. We are having, I think, 15 people coming over.
And you'll find lots of hamantaschen, a three-cornered treat filled with everything from raspberry to rosemary chocolate.
Which is your favorite?
Mine? I can eat 100 apricot hamantaschen in one sitting.
Strauss Bakery only carries hamantaschen for the holiday and made nearly 100,000 pounds of the special treat. Another commandment is to eat, drink, and be merry. So happy Purim. In Borough Park, Brooklyn, Cindy Hsu, CBS 2 News.
All right, so maybe a couple things that you picked up as you watched that little video. First, you know, they referenced that part of the Purim celebration is reading the story of Esther. Traditionally, the book of Esther would be read twice during the Purim holiday, once in the synagogue on the eve of Purim, as well as the following morning. And it wouldn't just stop at reading the story. Celebrating Purim involves mock reenactments of the book of Esther, complete with, as you saw, Halloween-like costumes. Purim is a lively festival. Of all the Jewish festivals, this one is the closest to sort of a carnival-esque sort of atmosphere, with much food and much drink at the center of all the festivities. And much of the food that's involved has connection to the story of Esther, as this news clip alluded to. So, for example, they mentioned those three-cornered pastries, the hamantash, which are, you know, literally transliterated would be Haman pockets, which are to symbolize the hat that the villain of the story, Haman, wears. The story also, or the news story also mentioned foods that have things hidden inside them, which reflects sort of this ongoing theme that keeps creeping up in the book of Esther. An obvious example of this is, of course, the heroine, Esther, who keeps her identity hidden through the story for a long period of time. Who she really is unknown to most of the story's characters until the time is right. Probably the most noteworthy thing that is hidden in the book of Esther is God. One of the unique features of the book of Esther is that it never mentions God once. In fact, not only does God not show up explicitly, but other religious details that you would expect in a Jewish text are completely absent. For instance, there is no mention of prayer. There is fasting, but no mention of associated prayer with fasting. Omissions of these kinds in an entire biblical book seem uncomfortably odd. And in fact, if you were to pick up and read the Greek translation of the story, guess what? There are significant additions to the text. There are paragraphs, chapters worth of extra material, which reference God a lot, and reference prayer a lot, and reference all kinds of other religious activities a lot. You get the sense that it's not just us here in the 21st century who might be uncomfortable with the Hebrew version of the story, that even people 2,000 years ago weren't sure what to do with it necessarily. And yet I would argue that as strange as it is that God is unmentioned in the text, his presence in the story is unmistakable. And maybe you picked that up in the comment that the one man in the news story there made when he said that though we don't always see God's presence, he is hidden somewhere. Though never named, the sense of God's active presence in the story, ensuring that his plans and purposes come to fruition, is thick in the text. Well, if God is in the background, in the foreground we have the story of a Jewish woman who ends up being in the right place and at the right time, in what seems to have all the hallmarks of a divine appointment that God has orchestrated. And though along the way she finds herself to be in circumstances and situations that she probably would never have imagined or chosen, she ends up needing to make a choice about whether or not she will partner with God in what God is up to in his world. And what is at stake is nothing less than the fate of God's chosen people. And so with that introduction, I'd like to go to the text, and we're going to read chapter 1, start to finish, and then we'll kind of recap it and take a look at what lessons we can maybe learn. So Esther, chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. Well, he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion. Which is kind of a strange phrase. The point there isn't that there is no compulsion as in, well, you don't have to drink if you don't want to. It means that there is no compulsion about the rules around drinking. There were customs about when it was appropriate to drink and when not, and the king said, away with that. Drink whenever you want, as much as you want. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Agabtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring King Vashti before the king, Queen Vashti before the king, with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. And at this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven priests of Persia and Media who saw the king's face and sat in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to the kings of all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him. Let it be written among the law of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. Well, this advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, to every people in its own language, that every man be the master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. All right, let's just do a brief recap and get a feel for what is going on in this chapter. Chapter 1 helps set the scene for describing this sort of over-the-top, grand picture of the palace of the king and of his reign. We're introduced to King Ahasuerus, who reigns over 127 provinces, covering a geographical area from India to Ethiopia. He sits on a throne in Susa. Not just a throne. The Hebrew throws in, you know, an extra descriptive word. It's the throne of his kingdom, just to sort of build up the sense of bigness and grandeur. Even his name, Ahasuerus, alerts us to his greatness as it seems to approximate the phrase mighty man. And mighty man decides that he wants to throw the party to end all parties. A massive eating and drinking party that has quite the guest list. The invitees include all the nobles and governors of his 127 provinces and the whole army of the Medes and Persians. And the party lasts for as long as it takes Ahasuerus to be able to display the full splendor of his greatness, which in this case, he decides, would take about 180 days. Mighty man does not appear to suffer from self-esteem issues. Now, at the end of the 180 days, it's still not enough. Though the days are full, which is the Hebrew word, the days are full, but it seems the people are not. There is appetite for more. So Ahasuerus throws yet another party, this time for all the people in his citadel, a seven-day feast in the palace garden. And as though we weren't already impressed with the extravagance of the king, the author ratchets things up even further and describes the specific decor of this encore party. Cotton curtains, violet hangings, marble pillars, couches of gold and silver, pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, other precious stones, gold vessels to drink out of, royal wine flowing, and an order given to the palace staff that whatever anyone wanted, they should have it. We better not hear the word no during this party. Now, in the meantime, we're told that the queen, Vashti is having her own feast with the women of the palace. Probably the initial 180-day banquet was of mixed company. But now we appear to have the men's club on their own for 7 days, which probably points all the more to the kind of excesses that may have been taking place. This party was likely, as Levinson puts it, an overdone stag party with all the licentiousness and disrespect that the term implies. The author tells us at the end of all the partying, as the end draws near, the king's heart was merry with wine. Like, thanks, Captain Obvious. I mean, he's been at it 187 days now. I think we've figured this part out. And now in this state, at the end of over half a year of partying, every possible display of greatness and grandeur has been shown off to everybody except one thing: Vashti, his queen. Vashti is the prime piece of property that will crown his 187-day display. This is going to be the ultimate moment, the crowning moment of the wild, lavish, say-no-to-nothing party. Just one problem. She says no to him. She won't come. Now, the text doesn't tell us why she won't come. One rabbinical suggestion is that maybe the order that she should come wearing her crown meant she was to come wearing only her crown. But the text doesn't tell us that specifically. In fact, the text doesn't say a whole lot about Vashti at all. It's as though the author is trying to write a screenplay for us, and he wants us to be aware that as we're watching this play out, yes, the queen is on the scene, but keep your eyes on the king. Watch how he reacts. Watch what he does. Pay attention to Ahasuerus in this moment. What's running through his mind? What do you imagine his body language to be when the eunuchs come back and say, "The queen ain't coming"? What? This is mighty man. Like, he's the guy. No one refuses him. And yet, for all the power and pomp and excess and grandeur, he can't get the queen to make an appearance. One woman pulls the rug out from under the most powerful man in the world, and she does so while the whole world is watching. It's delightful drama. Well, of course, mighty man can't let this go. When he asks what should be done, Memucan prefaces his suggestion by announcing that what the queen has done is not just an affront to the king. No, it actually puts every man in the whole empire from India to Ethiopia at risk. This could spark an uprising. It could create an atmosphere of contempt throughout the nation. It's a national emergency. It's a nuclear problem that needs a nuclear response. So first off, I mean, the queen is banished. That's a given. She is not going to see the king again. But apparently the king feels that that's not enough. And so in addition, all over the empire, in every city, in every out-of-the-way little village, the expected standard is to be reinforced. An edict is issued that men everywhere are to be masters of their own house. Kind of ironic, you know, in doing that, instead of concealing the embarrassing incident, it now gets published through the whole empire. People who otherwise would have had no idea that the queen didn't show up to the king's party when asked, now they would certainly find out that she had stood up to him. It's a very odd PR strategy. Kerry Moore writes that Ahasuerus would have brought into play the communication system of the whole entire Persian empire for such a purpose is ridiculous. Then again, drunken men sometimes are ridiculous. And really, like, what really was this decree going to accomplish? If a man has to command a woman to respect him, then whatever respect is so rendered loses its meaning. It's a sham. Yet these guys, they're smart. They're gonna go through with it, and they do. They put the plan in motion. Well, as we come to the end of the chapter, of course, we can't miss the fact that now the story has been set on a particular trajectory, and it needs to find resolution. Events have been set in motion. The edict that went out presumably included the original suggestion that kind of gets lost towards the end of the chapter, but the original suggestion, which was a declaration that not only would Vashti not see the king's face, but that someone would be chosen in her place to be queen. But who? And under what circumstances? Well, of course, that's for next week. That's for chapter 2. For this week, though, as we look at this opening scene of the story, what are a couple takeaways we might be able to hang on to? One of the things I think we're going to have to wrestle with as we go through the book of Esther is that there are so many instances throughout the book, not just in chapter 1, of over-the-top details in the story. The book is consistently larger than life. Characters are presented as caricatures. Details are pushed to and sometimes beyond the limit. Now, there's a couple different ways you can approach this. This really kind of gets into, like, how do we read our Bible? How are we going to deal with this? On one hand, you might hear that suggestion, and you might think, well, the Bible can't operate that way. It can't do those kind of things. And so I can't really accept that there would be storytelling elements in this book, which leaves sort of a certain set of problems you're going to have to overcome. The other option is to embrace the idea that biblical authors didn't shy away from using literary conventions like simile and metaphor and even hyperbole and other things. And if that's the case, and I want to suggest it is the case, it follows that the author would have used such conventions not for the purpose of obscuring the message of the text, but actually to bring the message of the text out, to shine a spotlight on it. In which case, we only most fully understand the message if we can embrace those things. They are in the text to point us to the point. In chapter 1, the author, I think, wants us to see Ahasuerus as the most grandiose, over-the-top, powerful leader imaginable. He is mighty man. The details of the size of his empire are either exaggerated or are deliberately framed in the most impressive way you could frame them. It would seem more normal, more natural for that day and age to talk about the 20 to 30 satrapies that made up the empire. And yet the author chooses instead to opt for a far more obscure way of dividing the empire up. He dices it into the smallest pieces possible so that he can give us the biggest number possible, 127 provinces. The details of the party itself are mind-boggling. I mean, from the descriptions of the opulence to the guest list, even to the time frame, all his governors and his entire army from the whole empire eating and drinking in excess for half a year. I mean, I can barely consume a single turkey dinner anymore without being stuffed and feeling like I couldn't eat for another 2 or 3 days. How many days of eating and drinking was necessary to satiate these people? This is certainly not a pragmatic banquet, let's put it that way. And it's not really smart either. I mean, think about it. If the entire government and law enforcement of this huge empire are at a party eating and drinking for 180 days, who's running the empire? I mean, this is a looter's paradise. So if the author is intentionally writing in these big and grandiose terms, I mean, what are we to make of it? What does he want us to make of this king? You know, maybe at first glance, we have this thought of, like, hey, I mean, who wouldn't want to be this guy? Unlimited power, unlimited resources, unlimited fun. I mean, he's literally the poster child for having it all. If this was a modern-day story, Ahasuerus would have his own reality show, and millions of people would tune in every day to see how the guy who has it all lives. We'd make a celebrity out of him. We'd wish we could be in his shoes just for 24 hours. And yet, when the author writes as he does and draws attention to the king's extravagance the way he does, I think when examined from sort of an outside third-party perspective, it all starts to look a little bit different. You see, for all that Ahasuerus has, he's really written into the story kind of as a buffoon. And this will carry through past chapter 1. A Jewish reader of this text, knowing well how the Old Testament calls people to live, the kind of life that we should emulate, would view this as sort of the ultimate picture of the person who's gotten it all wrong, not someone to be looked up to. Ahasuerus is a man who is rich in power and resources, but is morally bankrupt. That's a bad combination. The Bible uniformly cautions us about wealth and power without moral discernment. Ahasuerus acts like he's the one around whom the whole universe revolves, and yet his life turns out to be such a house of cards that he can make one stupid request that opens the door for one person to turn that world upside down. And then in response, he essentially compounds his error with more misjudgment. Now, the description of Ahasuerus and who he is and all that he has is so over the top that I think, you know, we can easily see that part of what isn't to be emulated in his life is clearly all these excesses. They are not presented as virtues. Which got me thinking a little bit. What's the difference? What's the difference between abundance and excess? What's the differentiator between divine blessing and human accumulation? How do we define excess? Is excess simply the next level beyond how much I have? Right? Like, if it's me, it's abundance, but the guy who's got more than me, well, he's living in excess. You know, none of us are Ahasuerus, and yet, I wonder what excesses define our own lives. We can't follow the author's implicit suggestion to reject the excess of the king without being willing to assess places of excess in our own lives, be that money, or food, or possessions, or leisure, or pleasure. An investment of some kind in the gratification of the desires of the flesh at the expense of walking in the Spirit. Of course, this isn't the only issue that Ahasuerus has. He's got some other significant character flaws, and they come to the forefront when he's forced to deal with adversity, when Vashti refuses to respond to his foolish demand. And again, certainly his over-the-top response looks buffoonish, and we can laugh it off as ridiculous, but there's a serious side to it. Because in this case, we see that his defects, his own character defects, don't just make him look stupid. They actually have real-world consequences beyond him. We observe in Ahasuerus that when people are vulnerable in the areas of pride and anger, oppression is not far behind. When people are vulnerable in the areas of pride and anger, oppression is not far behind. Others get hurt. There's a wake of brokenness and destruction that's left behind. So what about us? How do we deal with adversity? How do we deal with disappointment? In what way are we aware of the character deficiencies that we have, which, when acted out of, don't just hurt us, actually hurt people around us? And again, I know none of us is on the level of Ahasuerus. Our defects are not going to hurt an entire nation, most likely. But they certainly can cause pain to the loved ones in our lives. And in that respect, I'm guessing each of us can find a little bit of ourselves in the portrayal of this king. Now, on the other hand, we have Vashti, who is a lesser character in the story, but is there nonetheless. And though our glimpse of her is definitely too brief to make any sweeping claims about what she's like, in the way the author writes the story, she comes across as very much the total opposite of Mighty Man, where he appears morally bankrupt, self-centered, and immature. She comes off as a strong, noble, and grounded character. When ordered to show up to the king's party, she refuses. She knows that it's not that he misses her company, but rather that she's supposed to come as a piece of property, a show-and-tell item. She's supposed to set aside her dignity as a human being, allow herself to be degraded, maybe even compromised, simply for the king's pleasure and the delight of his friends. She's not having it, and ends up appearing as about the only upright and noble individual in the opening chapter. But here's the reality. She makes the virtuous choice, And as a result, she loses her position and she disappears from the story altogether. She does what appears to be the noble thing and she is set aside. Well, Ahasuerus acts immorally and stupidly and carries on in the story. You know, sometimes I think, though we'd probably never say it out loud, we live with this belief that if we do the right things, life will go the right way. And certainly as followers of Jesus, from an eternal perspective, that's absolutely true. But it's just not a reliable worldview when it comes to our experience of day-to-day life. If we think that doing the right thing means good things will always follow, we're going to be set up for deep disappointment. If we hold on to that too deeply, we might even start to question God himself. Right? I mean, if we put on God the burden of, well, if I do the right things, God, you better make my life good. I think we set ourselves up for spiritual failure. Doing good for self-serving reasons or trying to manipulate God for our benefit is off base. For followers of Jesus, it needs to be enough that we do the right thing because it's what Jesus calls us to, not because of what we get out of it. So, while on the one hand, the opening scene invites us to consider where we might reflect on the deficiencies and the excesses of the king, I also think it invites us to view the noble action of the queen and wrestle with the reality that sometimes doing the right thing doesn't work out in our favor from a human and temporal perspective. Do we have the courage? Do we have the virtue? Do we have the conviction to choose the right road, even to our own hurt in the short term, and trust vindication in eternity? I was reminded this week, as I was thinking about that, of the words of David in Psalm 15. O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? He who walks blamelessly and does what is right, speaks the truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue, does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt. I like that. Swears to his own hurt and does not change. Who does not put out his money at interest, does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. Do we trust God enough to obey him just because he's asked, even when the short-term results are difficult? Which I think sort of brings us full circle to the theme of the book, of this God who remains unmentioned and yet is unmistakable. Why do things go the way they do in the story? Why does this deficient king continue to play a big role in the story, and why is the more noble queen set aside? It's because that's what's required for the accomplishment of God's purposes. At the end of the day, these aren't characters in their own story. These are characters in God's story, as we are characters in God's story. And the more we embrace his story as the story we want to find ourselves in, the more we'll be able to embrace doing what is right as we trust the sovereignty of God, even when that may mean we become less so that he becomes more. And so may the ever-present God continue to build his kingdom through us. And may we offer ourselves to him to play whatever role in the story he's designed us for. And might that be our delight. Let's pray together. As we're in an attitude of prayer, I just invite you to take a moment of silence again. And as we often do, and invite God to speak into your life and maybe prompt you about a next step he's calling you to take, something he's spoken to you about today. So what is he speaking to you today? Dear child, how would you finish that sentence to reflect what the Spirit of God is speaking into your heart this morning? And then as you listen to the Holy Spirit's voice in your soul, what is your response this morning? Dear Holy Spirit, how will you finish that sentence today? So God, thank you that you have invited us to be characters in the story you are writing. wonderful story of redemption, restoration, recreation. God, we want to offer ourselves to you to continue to do the work you need to do in us, God, where there are things that we need to be rid of, where there are excesses in our lives, where there are character deficiencies, where there are things that do not reflect you or what you call us to. God, I pray that you would work on those things. Point them out to us. May we be willing partners with you in your refining work. And God, may we always choose obedience. May we choose character. May we choose the fruit of the Spirit. May we choose those things you call us to, even to our own hurt. May we be willing to be obedient. And trust that as we are obedient, whether that leads to a big role or a small role, it leads to Jesus being lifted high in our world. And that is our delight. And so we give ourselves to you, the God who is always with us, even when we can't see you, even when we don't hear you, even when we don't experience you. Thank you that you're always there. You're always there. We delight that your presence is always in our lives, and we say thank you. Amen.